Well, good afternoon, everybody. I hadn't originally expected to be delivering this session, but Ola, unfortunately, has had to go for unforeseen circumstances. So what we're going to be doing today is not so much media and audiences in the digital age, but still media and audiences, and something which I had really as a backup, which is relating very much to question five, critically evaluate the success of the tabloid newspapers in setting the news agenda in the latter part of the 20th century. And again, it might prove useful in essence if you choose to do this as your essay or indeed even as your presentation. It'll hopefully provide you with a template of some of the kind of key angles and some areas to be explored and developed and so on from that point of view. Okay, so technically, yes, it's sort of still relating to the digital age, but we're not really looking at the audience reception theory that I think Ola was originally looking to develop and so on. So, everybody clear about that? All sort? Fantastic. Good. I know it's an exciting week because this is the week when we actually get the order of your presentations in seminars, which is very exciting. Well, it's exciting for us as academics, if nothing else. Okay, let's make a start then. So what I really would like to talk about over the next 40 minutes or so is the comparative performances of different national newspaper titles. Why, for instance, has the Sun newspaper succeeded so spectacularly, specifically over the last quarter of the 20th century, and arguably still into where we are in the 21st century? I mean, we're still talking about a very worthwhile, viable, economically feasible newspaper. Whereas its nearest rival, the Daily Star, always seems to be threatened with closure. It never quite closes, but there's always takeovers, bids, and various other factors within that, which really seems at odds, given that primarily they tend to focus on the same target audience and so on. Last week, of course, we talked about how the national press responded to television, and we addressed the sort of ways in which the nationals that effectively saw television as a partner, as a symbiotic connector, actually survived. Those who kind of competed against it folded and have never been heard of again. Another question to actually consider is, why does the Daily Mail consistently outperform its nearest rival, the Daily Express? And why is that? What are the strategies that were introduced by the former editor, Paul Dacre, in terms of how that was developed and so on? And we'll also have a look at the changing nature of the content of Britain's national press. The differing characteristics between what we refer to as tabloids and broadsheets. Have those differences become blurred over the years? Have we seen the broadsheets tend to dumb down? Is there a place for them in a multimedia world in which, again, the whole notion of physically getting your newspaper delivered to you, or actually subscribing to it, or indeed going to a newsagent and actually getting a copy, almost seems anachronistic for folk in the sort of under 25 category. Certainly it's a case that many commentators have actually felt that the qualities have indeed dumbed down over the past 15, 20 years and so on. And before examining a number of individual titles and focusing on the content of the tabloids, I want to actually begin by highlighting the differing economic criteria that effectively are used to determine the success or otherwise of titles in the broadsheet and tabloid market. Something that effectively I go on to actually call, as Darwin might have said, the survival of the fittest. So, first question, what makes an economically successful newspaper? Well, as far as the broadsheets are concerned, for commercial success, the broadsheet newspapers rely not on sales, but on advertising revenue. A clear difference in terms of the business model of how they're developed, etc. Not on sales, but on advertising revenue. The financial model of the upmarket broadsheets, The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Times, are all advertising driven. Why? Because they can actually charge advertisers high rates for access to their affluent readership. you get far more A1, B1, C1s reading the up markets than you would in terms of the down market press and so on. So obviously, if you go back to that line I talked about in terms of radio, relating to how media deliver audiences to advertisers, clearly you're at the heart of the broadsheet model. And the broadsheets themselves are attractive to advertisers who themselves are selling expensive consumer products. Expensive cars, expensive holidays, expensive clothes. Again, these are all ways of actually targeting the rich, affluent consumer. Not just the Premiership footballer salaried individual, but the folk who effectively would aspire to go up that line. The, broadly speaking, over 80,000k a year market, in essence, or possibly the aspirational. And so in order to remain a suitable place for advertising higher salary jobs for people who might like those products and upmarket consumer products, the broadsheet paper has to ensure, as far as it can, that a high proportion of its readership are both educated, so you guys, and affluent. And if you think about that for one moment, what we're actually doing is paving the way, ideally, for a significant portion or proportion of broadsheet readership. Because you're looking to want to actually access stories that are going to be in more detail, in considerable more line than you'd actually get in your average tabloid. So whilst the upmarket newspaper primarily also would love to have more readers, and of course the revenue from sales advertising that would actually bring, it really only wants more affluent and preferably young readers. You've always got to have a model in which you actually deal with the coffin dodgers, the people who are effectively passing on in their latter 70s, 80s, 90s and so on. You want a new incoming breed of readership, people who effectively can be targeted whilst you're in the sort of area of 15, 25 and so on. It was estimated that in 1993, the Daily Telegraph, which was arguably the most successful daily broadsheet, was earning in advertising revenue per copy 10 times as much as the Sun newspaper. That's a significant shift, 10 times as much as the Sun newspaper. So it's quite clear that in the case of the broadsheets, raising one's circulation didn't necessarily enhance the profitability of the title. You know, it's the kind of, you want the right readership. If those additional readers were of the wrong sort, and I'm conscious you've got an interesting line here in terms of how would you define the wrong sort of readers. Well, people who don't fall into that top level earning category. People who might sort of have as a sideline, do you want chips with that? Sorry to any sort of people who actually want fries, etc. But it's a difficult sort of issue to deal with. The Times actually found this to be a classic case of, yes, this is exactly what is happening in the 1960s. This is before Rupert Murdoch took over the Times. Between 1966 and 1969, the Times actually increased its circulation by 60%, and it did this through heavy advertising and adopting a much more popular editorial style. However, a considerable proportion of the new readers were penniless students, lower middle class, or even, shock horror, working class people. This immediately prompted protests from advertisers who objected to paying high advertising rates for the privilege of reaching large numbers of people who couldn't afford the products that they're trying to sell. What's the point of advertising an automobile for 150,000 or holidays for 40,000, 50,000, etc., if it's always going to be beyond the reach of your reader? Consequently, advertising fails to keep up with the rise of circulation. It's selling more newspapers, but the advertising isn't going up. And so the newspaper as a whole suffered heavy losses. And as a direct result of that, the Times reversed its policy. It raised its price. It adopted a much more serious and sober editorial style and successfully shed 96,000 readers. But the readers it kept were the right kind. You don't necessarily need to have mass readership to actually qualify for being a successful newspaper. And when the Times went for rapid growth again in the 1990s, it deliberately targeted the Daily Telegraph readers and the Daily Mail readers, whose consumption patterns appeals to advertisers. Anybody who looked at the BBC story behind the scenes at Jeff Bezos and Amazon, and the notion of Bezos effectively now being, or having always been, in the business of data mining and knowing everything about everybody in terms of every purchase you've ever actually made, will appreciate the line that's kind of being taken here. It's using market information to effectively make your product better. It's basic business capital work. So what at the same time was happening to the tabloids in this particular period, the latter years of the 20th century? Well, as I've already said, the broadsheets relied primarily on advertising revenue. The tabloids, like the Sun and the Star and the Mirror, are dependent primarily on sales revenues, numbers of copies actually sold at newsstands and so on. And as a consequence, the tabloids, especially those red-top tabloids such as the Sun, the Mirror, and the Daily Star, are in a continuing sales war with each other. Hence, shock, horror, scandalous, lurid headlines. Lots of paparazzi-style shots. Lots of simple catch-all headlines and so on. For in order to retain profitability for those newspapers, sales have to be maximised, irrespective of the spending power of the potential reader. I'm not saying that people who are university educated will never read the Sun, the Star, the Mirror. Of course they do. Of course, you know, we do as a matter of course. There are lots of educated university folk who will actually work for those newspapers. But in the main, you're looking at how they're being targeted and developed. Eddie Shah tried to establish an alternative in the 1980s and developed a paper called Today, which was the first colour daily newspaper, which was supposed to target those mid-market areas. It closed down despite actually having a circulation of over 500,000. 573,000 per day were sold, significantly more than the broadsheet Guardian or indeed the Financial Times. But even 500,000 on a sales-only system wasn't enough to keep the newspaper alive. And the fate of the Today newspaper echoed that of a number of popular tabloids, which were not quite popular enough. I mentioned some of them last week, like the News Chronicle, like the Daily Herald. The News Chronicle, when it closed in 1960, was selling 1.1 million copies a day. The Daily Herald closed with a circulation of 1.3 million in 1964, but was then relaunched as the Sun. So you could say that the Sun appeared in 1964 for the first time, phoenix-like, from the ashes of the Daily Herald. So with that in mind, let's consider the next stage. Let's look at the three sections of the national daily market over the last 30 or so years. We've considered the notion of what makes an economically successful paper. We've got the line about how broadsheets survive and thrive. We've got the line of how tabloids survive and thrive. We've looked at all of those particular aspects. We're now actually going to consider the next stage, which is, of course, the downmarket tabloids. And we're going to begin to analyse and look in detail at some of the techniques that have been used with respect to this. Well, sales of the downmarket tabloid titles, such as those listed there, grew slightly from 1965 to 1995. It moved primarily from roughly 35 million copies per week being sold in 1965 to 44 million weekly copies in 1995. It's kind of tailed off now. We're now into the sort of the 20s and 25 million mark, etc. There has been a falling off with respect to the nationals, but not as precipitous as that in local press, which is another topic for another lecture. There was, however, a big switch in this time in what was the dominant market leader, the dominant company for the tabloids. In 1965, the year before, of course, England's World Cup winning success, the Mirror Group was dominant in the market sector. By 1995, the success of the Sun newspaper made Rupert Murdoch's News International the leading company. So why? Why did this actually occur? Well, The Sun and The Times was bought by Rupert Murdoch in November 1969, shortly after the purchase of the News of the World, which one or two of you may remember as one of the casualties of the phone hacking scandal a few years ago, and the closure of the News of the World, which in itself had been running pretty much in a similar format since the 19th century, the mid to end of the 19th century. The sales of The Sun newspaper grew rapidly in the 1970s. When Murdoch actually bought the paper, it had sales of approximately a million a year. By 1975, that had gone up to 3.5 million, actually a day. Sorry, what I'm saying, million a day. By 1975, it was selling 3.5 million. Now, contrary to popular opinion, this is not necessarily the publishing of a female nude on page 3 each day, which explained the rapid growth, because actually the paper grew most quickly in the year before the page 3 topless model actually appeared. According to Jeremy Tunstall, there were several more important factors behind the paper's success. The first editor of The Sun was Larry Lamb, L-A-M-B. And he noted that the daily papers had basically been always pitched above the Sundays in terms of quality, despite the Sundays' higher sales figures. So when it came to sex and scandal, the Sunday newspapers would always win out. And both Rupert Murdoch and Larry Lamb felt that there was a place in the national daily market for a title that emulated the downmarket sensationalism, sex, and scandal, that had characterised the News of the World pretty much from its launch in the middle of the 19th century, the 1840s. In short, Rupert Murdoch felt that the popular dailies were actually overestimating the tastes of the British public. Those accusations clearly tie into the notion that Rupert Murdoch was then being seen as producing salacious or dirty or scandalous newspapers, certainly in the shape of the News of the World and The Sun. David Frost actually cited as much when he was interviewed on a London weekend television chat show. Murdoch understandably resisted the charge, although Private Eye instantly renamed him the Dirty Digger. Obviously Australian, and clearly sort of somewhat questionable in his morals. Equally as the Sun editor, Larry Lamb adopted much of what was popular in the News of the World. First of all, he abolished all specialist news jobs, except for political journalists. So whereas you would have had a fashion specialist, you would have had a lifestyle specialist, you would have had a home news specialist, a consumer specialist, etc., that all went. Effectively, you had to do a whole variety of jobs unless you were a political journalist. And the focus was very much on human interest. It was on entertainment. It was on sex. And it was sport. Those were the clear areas that they were wanting to push as the popular way forward. Not too dissimilar to the early days of the internet, in which actually it was primarily sex, science fiction and sport that effectively kind of drove the sort of development of the web and so on. The Sun itself was also extensively advertised. I mentioned this last week. It was advertised largely on television. And there were also lots of new marketing ploys that were being introduced, such as promotional contests. Perhaps Murdoch's most important innovation was the introduction of sale or return. Now, this phenomenon, if anybody's worked in a newsagent, those wonderful things that used to exist, were effectively where newsagents would be given loads of copies of the newspaper, hundreds of copies of the newspaper, but they only had to pay for those that they sold. So if they didn't actually sell the newspaper, it could actually be returned, and the newsagent didn't actually have to pay for them. It's no surprise, then, that The Sun, adopting that business model, became Britain's biggest-selling newspaper in the winter of 1977 to 1978, when it actually overtook the Daily Mirror, whose sales had been in steady decline since the 1960s. Politically, also, we're seeing this notion that the Mirror was seen very much as left-wing sympathetic, ideologically more working class, still populist, but at the end of the day, still likely to be anti Tory administration, whereas the Sun was very much the opposite of that. To use the line in terms of the election of 1994, it was the Sun what won it. Arguably, the Sun was never guilty of overestimating levels of taste. But maybe the Daily Mirror overestimated the earnestness of its readership. The Mirror, as I mentioned, had a reputation as a campaigning newspaper with Labour sympathies. And under its editor, it had a mission to educate. Now, Murdoch and Lamb were both dismissive of the Mirror, and especially an innovation which was a 3 times a week pull-out supplement called Mirroscope. This was a sort of tabloid Guardian which contained in-depth material about science and the arts. According to Lamb, Mirroscope was a pull-out all right. It was pulled out and thrown away. The top decks of buses were ankle-deep in copies. So the line that basically people didn't want to use their newspaper for anything other than salacious gossip and entertainment and sports news. Those were the fundamentals. And you can't argue with some of the figures, I suppose, if you're looking at them from a sort of analytical perspective. The Daily Mirror during the late 1960s was actually admired in the newspaper industry for its journalism. But crucially, it was losing touch with younger working class people. Again, that next generation of readership, as a result of its overcautious and responsible approach to news coverage. It would check sources. It wouldn't actually print huge scandalous headlines on the basis of things being, you know, not being checked and so on. For example, the Daily Mirror would actually play down the Moore's murder case in 1966 with Mara Hindley and Ian Brady, when even its mid-market rivals such as The Express would be prone to sensationalism. The Sun's sales, as I mentioned, rose steadily between 1969 and 1978, and its first sales dip actually coincided with the launch of the Daily Star in November 1978. Now, the Daily Star was originally started by Express newspapers as a way to actually use the spare capacity of the Manchester presses of the Daily Express. One of the things about traditional newspaper printing is you need to keep the presses continually going. You've got pulp newspaper going in. You need to actually produce stuff on a regular basis. The Star was originally planned to compete with the Sun, although it's never really done so successfully, despite the use of a number of ploys, ranging from bingo wars, Sun bingo, Star bingo, etc., price reductions, and actually a fairly disastrous plunge even further down market in 1987 when it moved into soft pornography. Between 1986 and 1988, the Daily Star actually lost 27% of its sales. It's interesting in terms of Tunstall's argument that the Sun didn't follow the Star into soft pornography, because the Sun's editors understood their 10 million daily readers. They wanted smut, they didn't want filth. They wanted sensationalism and gossip, but they didn't want pornography on that basis. Now, it can be said that the Sun has on occasion apparently captured the popular mood, and a quick search through Google looking at Sun tabloid headlines will reveal a number of memorable headlines, such as Gotcha, with the sinking of the Belgrano during the Falklands War. The 1990 anti-European cry, Up Yours Delors, some might say is one of the real crystallising moments which led to our current Brexit experiences and so on. But there have still been, within the Sun, a number of expensive errors. And perhaps the most famously costly error in the Sun's history is something which I suspect, even though very few people, maybe one or two people might have been born at the time, myself included, was the Sun's coverage of the 1989 Hillsborough disaster. Again, still resonating. Still, we have a situation in Merseyside where the Sun newspaper sales are substantially lower than other newspapers and so on. Again, I suspect you may be familiar with the story, but the coverage of this particular disaster in which 96 Liverpool football supporters were crushed to death was followed 3 days after the event by The Sun running a front page headline headlined The Truth, which claimed that drunken Liverpool fans viciously attacked rescue workers as they tried to revive victims. Some thugs rifled the pockets of injured fans as they were stretched out unconscious on the pitch, and so on. Total fabrication, and probably a classic example of fake news, misreporting, playing into stereotypes, playing into aspects which clearly we would regard, and indeed legally have been shown, to actually be offensive and fundamentally wrong. As a consequence of the story, as I mentioned, The Sun was boycotted on Merseyside, and its circulation there is still, compared to the rest of the country, disproportionately low. Now, in addition to that fabricated story, The Sun has also been responsible for a series of excessive intrusions into privacy and what we would regard as distasteful checkbook journalism incidents, which culminated in the 90s in The Sun losing a libel case to Elton John. How did they lose a libel case to Elton John? Well, they claimed that he was using the services of male prostitutes. Again, no substantial evidence. The Sun actually employed unsubstantiated testimony, bought apparently from a known criminal, and also then used old personal photographs of entirely legal sex acts committed in private. Now, again, not only were the details of the story found to be untrue, but they were also so graphic as to shock the sensitive readers of The Sun. And Elton John, that's aptly really, given that we have the Brit Awards this evening, it's going to be a win for Stormzy, or is it actually going to be, no, a poor night for Stormzy, but a positive night for, who's the guy who had the hit with Bruises? How many? Hit with Bruises? No? Louis? Okay, thank you, exactly, Louis Capaldi. Louis, thing. Well, it's good to see somebody's got their cultural finger on the pulse there. Primarily, having to pay Elton John £1 million in compensation was just a side product. Reputations were clearly happening here. There were clearly issues that were impacting in terms of how The Sun was operating and so on and so forth. And the whole question mark of press intrusion begins to rear its head. For the first time in April 1989, the Home Secretary set up a committee to examine the possibility of the introduction of measures to prevent excessive intrusion into individuals' privacy by the press. This committee was chaired by David Calcutt. It's referred to as the Calcutt Commission, C-A-L-C-U-T-T. And it reported that in 1990, the previous two decades had seen changes in the character of the tabloid market with a degree of competition not present since the days pre-Second World War. And in their own words, this may have led some tabloid editors to feel let off the leash, to become more intrusive in pursuit of competitive advantage. The content of these papers has become less political and more revelatory of the lives of show business personalities and royalty. Hadn't mentioned the R word before, but again, well worth commenting on in terms of there's nothing like a good royal scandal to really open up things. The result of the Calcutt Committee was the setting up of the Press Complaints Commission, the PCC. And that was designed to replace what was generally seen as fairly toothless, ineffectual, the Press Council. It was supposed to be a much tighter, self-regulatory body. It would include editors of the tabloids who would be given the task of drawing up and upholding press guidelines. It was certainly made clear by Kenneth Clark, Home Secretary at the time, that the press were on probation, that they were drinking in the last chance saloon. Now, despite Calcutt's critical review of the press's behaviour in 1993, no changes in the regulations actually occurred until the death of Princess Diana in August 1997. And, of course, the role of the paparazzi in this accident, which brought about an even tighter code of practice, which the press hoped would mean that the continuing self-regulation would mean or present the argument that regulation was being handled internally. It's interesting, I did an interview for BBC Humberside last night about the views of the tragic death of the Love Island presenter Caroline Flack. You can listen to it online if you want to, through iPlayer. But it was very much taken from similar kind of aspects. Again, the argument is 23 years, ballpark, since death of Diana. Are we still in that ballpark? I'm not saying Caroline Flack was royal, but again, similar kind of techniques being used, social media, etc., etc. Something which will continue to be debated and put through, as indeed we talk about other press intrusions and the Leveson Committee and so on and so forth. But let's move on to the middle market ones. We've looked at, in a sense, the bottom of the pile. We've looked at the Mirror. We've looked at the Sun. We've looked at the Star. Let's consider what are primarily seen, in national terms at least, as the mid-market papers. The Daily Mail and the Daily Express. Between 1965 and 1995, the mid-market newspapers actually suffered a substantial reduction in terms of their market share. In 1965, 49% of national daily newspaper sales were in the market, in the mid-market area. That's literally just under a half, which is, you know, substantial numbers. But by 1995, only 27% of all daily national newspaper sales were in this sector of the market. So within 30 years, they basically lost a quarter of their share of the market. And again, it's hovering around the sort of 20% figure at present. The mid-market group of titles, as I mentioned last week, were badly hit by the arrival of television. In Britain, the television industry, as we mentioned, was committed in its news coverage to a consensual and mid-market approach, whether you're talking about ITV or BBC. Certainly by the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s, even with the advent of Channel 4, there was very little difference in terms of the kind of content and style that was actually being presented. Meanwhile, upmarket and downmarket shares of the national newspapers had both prospered for differing reasons. Obviously, the right kind of advertisers for the broadsheets and Sex and Scandal and Sport for the downmarket areas. The upmarket news would primarily also offer something that was more demanding than television. It would offer long-form interviews. It would offer the opportunity for you to read a story in much more detail than would be provided in a 5, 10, 15 or 20 minute news bulletin, etc. Unless you're watching documentaries, which again, slightly different issue. Downmarket newspapers would also prosper by locating themselves as increasingly complementary to and dependent on television. What better way to promote sales of your newspapers than having favourite soap stars or Anton Deck or presenters or lines within that being, you know, featured regularly within the covers and so on and so forth. Having columns, very popular. Celebrity columnists also developing within that field. The readership of the Daily Express and its sales figures have fallen pretty steadily since the 1960s. This was caused in part by the fact that the readers it had recruited during its growth years, the 1930s and 1940s, were, to be honest, growing old and they were dying. And the Daily Express's attempts to attract a younger readership have been relatively unsuccessful. There have been a number of revamps, including the arrival in the 90s of a high-profile female editor called Rosie Boycott. Indeed, Rosie and myself worked together on the establishment of Express FM, which was supposed to be a series of small-scale community-based stations and radio aspects in the 90s, which were again designed to enhance the awareness of the newspaper by promoting it through radio, etc. Again, it evolved in all sorts of ways, and maybe, as I say, Siren has its roots back in there. The Independent had also launched at this period of time. Now, the Independent had launched as a broadsheet newspaper sort of around the same time as the Today Eddie Shah newspaper had done. And that also demonstrated a slight shift towards the political left and indeed still right of centre compared to Richard Desmond's Northern and Shell company takeover of Express newspapers. Richard Desmond, primarily known for investing in an awful lot of soft porn magazines before he effectively took over the Daily Express and the Daily Star. And again, I think that kind of resonates in a number of ways. He's since sold them, and indeed his interest in Channel 5. But the position of the Daily Express and the paper's role in the newspaper ecology is still vulnerable, particularly since the leaner Daily Mail began to outsell it throughout the 1990s. Until 1990, the Daily Express would consistently outsell the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail circulation of 2.3 million per day was double that of the Express, 1 million a day. Only three national daily newspapers actually increased their circulation through the 1990s, the Financial Times being one of them, and interestingly enough, the Financial Times sold most of its additional copies abroad to overseas readers and subscribers. The Times, as we mentioned, used some price-cutting tactics, but more sensitive to the ones they tried in the 1960s, to actually increase its sales rate. And the other, the third newspaper that increased its circulation in the 1990s, and still to the present day, was the Daily Mail. Now, according to the former editor of The Guardian, Peter Preston, the Mail's success was due to two key individuals. Two, as he defined them, brilliantly professional editors. And they were David English and Paul Dacre, D-A-C-R-E. It was also due, apparently, according to Preston, to one exceptional proprietor, the late Lord Rothermere. Lord Rothermere had invested heavily in both journalism and marketing. So he actually managed to get that perfect storm. He got a populist mid-market newspaper, which became one of the nation's most profitable papers, which brings in significant income through sales revenues, as is required of any tabloid newspaper, as we've said. But also, its advertising income is also extremely healthy, because it also targets very successfully many affluent or influential housewives, and women who are basically looking to develop their careers in a whole variety of other aspects, which are also key Daily Mail readers. It does indeed have as many social grade A readers as the Times, and it's also got more ABC ones than the Times and the Telegraph combined. So it's a real success on that basis, despite one's views and almost embarrassment about its particular views and aspects. It's very interesting that since Geordie Gregg took over as editor, that the anti-European line that the Mail took has been toned down substantially. But that, again, may be a case of shutting the barn door after the horse has bolted, etc. In addition to the balance of good editorship, good ownership, etc., it also managed to balance its elderly readership with its younger readership. And it also started bringing on a whole range of star quality columnists, people like Nigel Dempster, passed away a few years ago, very much a sophisticated gossip columnist. Likewise, Linda Lee Potter. All of those, again, impacted in terms of what we see as the way in which the marketplace is developed and so on. So we're reaching the stage now whereby that social composition of the readership of the most popular mid-market tabloid, the Daily Mail, actually, on one level, has much in common with the quality broadsheets. In other words, a substantial number of its readers are professional people with spending power. The Mail's readership isn't significantly different from, indeed, the Daily Telegraph. Is the content of the paper, though? Or are we looking at the Telegraph and the Mail as broadly seeing ideologically similar? Is there a blurring around the edges of the tabloid broadsheet divide? Now, certainly there are some aspects of the Mail's journalistic convention, or the conventions that they employ, which arguably have much in common with other tabloids. Its questionable use of checkbook journalism techniques during the Yorkshire Ripper murder trial of the 1980s, for instance, being one. But some elements of the Mail do share similar characteristics to the broadsheets, such as its fondness for, as I mentioned, the celebrity columnist. Now, the proliferation of columnists in the quality press is one of the key areas that has caused a great deal of disquiet. Many people actually see this as evidence of dumbing down. Julian Petley's article, Faces for Spaces, in a textbook called A Journalism Reader by O'Malley and Bromley, is particularly condemnatory of the non-political columns that have sprung up across the tabloid and quality ends of the market. Whether it be Lorraine Kelly, whether it be Jeremy Clarkson, whether it be any of the sort of columnists who kind of crop up as actually giving their viewpoints, etc. Untrained writers who are basically hired and often use ghostwriters to get their comments across for their celebrity outside the area. Often been seen as something that actually that growth of columnists has padded out the expanding pages of the newspapers, particularly at weekends, because again, obviously, most of those newspapers that I mentioned do have supplements and weekend editions that go along as well, and they are padded out by the celebrity column as well. It's often regarded that those columnists were also ways of encouraging lazy, bigoted, and under-researched journalism in place of the slightly more expensive to maintain foreign news desks and investigative journalism, which used to be a staple of the quality end of the market. So somehow employing the celebrity is a relatively cheap way of kind of having one sort of way of attracting more newspaper readers, but at the same time causing issues that are working within that. Now, that's not to say that columnists are cheap. William Rees-Mogg, of course, father of Jacob, was actually paid £60,000 for one column by The Independent. That's a week, by the way. Not bad. Writing one column in a newspaper, get £60,000. Gets better, actually. He was paid £120,000 for two columns by The Times in the early 1990s. Julie Burchell, who's still known, etc., was actually paid £120,000 per annum for 2 hours' work per week when she was a columnist for The Nail on Sunday. Again, not too bad. 2 hours' work a week, £120,000 a year. It's interesting that Petley also expressed surprise that Burchell's column took as long to write as 2 hours a week. But ultimately, as indeed he concluded, in this consideration of columnists' punditry and the growth of the celebrity pundit, that it simply magnified the shortcomings of the press as a whole. In Petley's words, it doesn't attempt to inform or educate the public, rather it tells the public what it thinks they want to hear, and simply stokes the fires of popular prejudices and mythologies. It's the Rod Little effect. Bigotry over the breakfast table. For the columnists, you might argue it beats working for a living. So we have this situation where the dumbing down of the quality press has also been seen to be taking place in other ways as well. For instance, the growth of fantasy football. The quality press in particular now pays substantially more attention to popular culture than was the case 30 years ago. A Times-reading High Court judge in the 1960s arguably could be forgiven for not knowing who the Beatles were. But his 1990s equivalent, reading the same newspaper, The Times, would probably name every one of the Spice Girls. The broadsheet's news agenda seems to have much more in common with the popular tabloids than was the case even 15 years ago. It's interesting, when The Independent launched in 1986, it vowed to avoid as much as possible reporting on the minutiae of the royal family. Another member of the royal family is getting divorced. They're just falling like flies. Do we care? It seems to be required reading, though, across the newspaper industry and newspaper titles. Whether you are the Times newspaper talking about Prince William's friends having a penchant for soft drugs, before he obviously married Kate Middleton, etc. And don't get me started on Harry and Meghan, because there's a whole range of issues and ruft of things with respect to that. And perhaps, as we've already seen in this particular series of lectures over the last few weeks, the area in which the qualities have expanded most rapidly in recent years is their coverage of sport. There is another lecture which I might be able to squeeze in, not today, about sport and the media and so on. In March 1990, the Daily Telegraph launched the first standalone national newspaper sporting supplement. In the past decade, The section has not only survived the Telegraph, but been imitated by all of the paper's broadsheets competitors. So you've got The Guardian, Pullout, you've got The Times, The Game, and so on and so forth. So the arguments do seem persuasive for this dumbing down of the quality press, influenced by the success of the tabloids. Serious journalism being replaced by journalism light in the shape of columnists. Personality-led stories and features becoming increasingly common. And sport, especially football, becoming a crucial part of most broadsheets' news agenda. However, there's also evidence to suggest that maybe the dumbing down has to a certain extent been overstated. The quality press does actually have a much greater share of the marketplace now than used to be the case. In 1965, 13% of national daily sales were of the upmarket titles. That rose to 20% by the end of the 90s, and is now hovering again around the 20-25% mark. Certainly, whilst the coverage of popular culture and sport has increased substantially within the papers have also increased considerably in size. The average size of the Times in 1966 was 22 pages, 1995, 56 pages. It's still around the sort of 40-page mark or so now. Since the arrival of The Sun, arguably the only successful newly launched down-market title, we've also seen the arrival, as I mentioned, of The Independent, and, of course, the demise of the broadsheet Independent, or the online of that, but the establishment of The Eye, which is, in a sense, a digest newspaper that's within that. And those values of The Eye still tend to echo the notion of serious journalistic values and so on. So, do we conclude that the quality press has dumbed down in terms of where things are going? Well, again, it's difficult to really make huge sweeping generalisations. It's always dangerous to do so, especially when we're living in a newspaper ecology where we may arguably be seeing perhaps, again, another stage in the evolution in terms of how it comes to terms with the growing online aspect, etc. All of the newspapers I've talked about today do have substantial online presences. Are they successfully monetized? Well, not really. The Mail will actually use Mail Online effectively with a whole range of clickbait to actually take you through a variety of other areas and so on. But even attempts to actually monetize and subscribe to Telegraph Online, Guardian Online, etc., tend to be somewhat challenging. They haven't quite cracked that challenge as yet. And, of course, the spectre in the room is the onset of Google, Facebook, and other issues as well. I'll leave you then with the thought that in terms of the press, maybe we're emblematic of that whole notion of the runner on the track. You know, we kind of know roughly the direction that we're heading in, but ultimately in terms of its final destination, well, that's still very much up in the air. Have a splendid reading week. I look forward to seeing you in your seminar groups, and we will catch up again then.